Offer some final thoughts on what we've heard today and on where the project will go from here. And then, as I say, I'll give everybody a chance to say final words of wisdom if you feel like it, and then we can take a break before champagne. Is that it? Yeah, we're supposed to have champagne soon. Trevor.
Thank you very much, Louise, and thank you, everyone, for participating today. I think these panels have certainly given us a lot of food for thought for our continuing research agenda. And there were just a few points that I want to highlight that I thought came out of today's panels. You may or may not disagree, but we'll be taking these away and thinking about these very seriously. The first thing I thought came from Elizabeth Dalzell's presentation, and I was incredibly impressed by the care with which her consultation process was conducted within Canada on the issue of nuclear waste. And it occurs to me that very same model involving all stakeholders in a very careful, open, deliberative process can also be used to consider the issue of nuclear energy generally. And in particular, from our project's point of view, in considering how global governance should be adjusted in the light of nuclear energy developments. The point was made, I think, particularly strikingly when we talked about fuel assurances, that any regime that designs fuel assurances should take into account not just the provider's views and the provider's regulations and stipulations, but also the views of those on the receiving end of the assurances. So this regime should be constructed with all parties involved to arrive at a mutually agreeable solution to the fuel assurance problem. And it occurs to me that the internal Canadian process led by Elizabeth Dalzell is an excellent model that we can adapt to global governance problems, particularly in this nuclear area. A second thing that struck me was the very different perspectives that countries bring to their nuclear energy problems and their energy problems in general. It was very striking, for instance, how Japan views the economics of its nuclear industry compared to how the United States does, and indeed we just heard most recently about the case of Australia. Clearly there are some values that the Japanese internalize within their estimation of the value of nuclear power that probably would not be acceptable in a country that had a vast amounts of energy, much more than Japan does. So a country that is resource poor places a higher value on the sorts of nuclear reprocessing, those sorts of activities, than a country with vast amounts of natural uranium and indeed alternative energy sources. So I think in our project we'll be looking at the vast array of views that can be had on the nuclear issue depending on the particular country's own domestic circumstances. And I think that's a very important thing we need to bear in mind. We can't paint all countries with the same brush in terms of their consideration of the value of nuclear power, because some values, particularly social values that can't have a figure put on them, certainly are valued differently by different countries. A third point that struck me is that even though we talk about a renaissance, we're not quite in it yet. And the very long lead times, the various shortages of fuel, of technology and of technical expertise will delay this renaissance no matter how urgent it is perceived and no matter how fast governments want to go on this. And it also strikes me that the regulatory framework will either facilitate or hold back developments depending on the country concerned. I was particularly struck by Japan's case where internal self-regulation of safety has in fact done the opposite of a level playing field and actually put Japan at somewhat of a disadvantage, but because of their sensitivity to accidents and the self-perceived need for more inspections, that this somehow creates a different situation in Japan to, say, the United States or Canada. So again, I think we need to be very careful when we talk about the Renaissance, and our project will be quite careful in characterising exactly what sort of Renaissance this is. Another point on the technical issues, it's clear that the reaction from Ed Lyman's presentation that the technical issues are still very much contested. And while our project doesn't really have to resolve these, we do have to bear in mind that within particular countries, as they make their national energy policies clearer, that these technical issues will be contested, and that they, decisions about the technical issues can't take place in a technical vacuum. It has to be done in terms of the social values and in particular the economics, of course. On the economics question itself, it struck me yesterday from the presentation by the gentleman from Goldman Sachs that if we still don't have a very good handle on how much energy it takes to produce a given volume of energy from uranium, then we clearly have a few more questions for the economists and those who figure out these matters, and that strikes me as something our project will be very interested in, just how economic is uranium from the point of view of the amount of energy that you need to actually produce a given amount of energy from uranium. And I guess the Alberta tar sands is the example that's sitting in my head there. It seems to me that the whole question of assurances of supply and the various regime proposals we've heard about today is a very fertile field for research. Examining the costs and benefits of each individual proposal, but also seeing what compatibility there is between various proposals and how these might be constructed into a regime, but again with all the stakeholders involved. So I think I would end on the note that our project's goal is not to resolve all these uncertainties. We have to simply try and determine how governments themselves will face these uncertainties and how they will make decisions about to proceed or not with nuclear power, and then in turn how these decisions collectively will have an impact on global governance. So we're very excited about the sorts of ideas that have already come to us from Joe Cirincione and others about the next stage of our project, which is the impact on global governance, and hopefully we'll be able to draw on the expertise of all our panels and you amongst the audience who are interested in this issue as we go forward. We hope to be running draft ideas past various stakeholders and various interest groups as we move towards the conclusion of the proposal. So we're hoping that you who are interested in this issue can be involved in that process. So thank you very much for your participation and for attending today's sessions. Thank you.
Thank you, Trevor, for drawing a number of very very important points that will be reflected in the next phase of our work. I would like to add just two considerations. Is that as I was listening to all the presentation, it was clear to me that whether we were looking at a small renaissance or a large renaissance, that there are issues of global governance that require attention. That's one conclusion. And secondly, that even if Joe Cirincione's very optimistic and I must say very stimulating view of where we are at with respect to non-proliferation problems, that even if we solve all these non-proliferation problems through total disarmament, there will continue to be nuclear power plants around the world that have to be operated safely and securely, and that do not endanger the life or safety or security not only of the citizens of the country where they're located, but also in neighboring countries, hence a set of global governance issues that exist beyond the non-proliferation concern, which is admittedly the most complicated and the most frightening part of the global governance concern. But there are others that will continue to require attention. And I thought that Edwin Lyman's presentation this morning, even though some people thought he was too negative on nuclear energy, I think was a useful reminder that even in a country that prides itself in its record of safety and the care it has given to managing its nuclear industry, still has not achieved perfection. And that suggests that internationally as well, I doubt that we have achieved a perfect global governance system to ensure the safe operation of nuclear power plants. That will be it for my own 2 cents worth at the end of this extraordinarily interesting day from my perspective. I turn the floor over to you if you have... Gerald? Yes.
Thanks. Jerry Wright from the National Electricity Roundtable. It's been an excellent day. Just one or two undoubtedly picayune comments about your framework. I wasn't entirely clear what you regarded as the optimum result, and therefore what the criterion would be that you would be using in assessing the governance mechanisms. I know we all want a safer world, but it seems to me that the objective has to be presented in a little more detailed fashion than if the investigation of the governance mechanisms is going to yield a really useful and interesting result. Secondly, taking off from Trevor's remarks about whether maybe the nuclear renaissance isn't going to be as substantial as we might think, I think it's quite revealing sometimes that national projections, such as our own in Canada's or the U.S. DOE's, are often much more cautious about nuclear, as in the case of the U.S. DOE, even a Department of Energy that's under the Bush administration, that must take into consideration what it considers to be constraints that are more substantial than some of the euphoric nuclear enthusiasts would have us believe. And I wondered in that connection whether your framework is missing reference to the supply mix, which surely must be a determinant of many jurisdictions' decision as to whether or not they're going to go nuclear. Take, for example, the province of Nova Scotia, which has a requirement of about 2,200 megawatts. If they were to opt for a nuclear plant, that would mean knocking out about 600 megawatts at least of generation. It would probably subvert their objective to have diversity of energy sources. It would be a quite impractical decision for them to take. And it seems to me that the supply mix would figure in the decision of many jurisdictions as to whether or not they would opt for nuclear technology.
Trevor?
Thanks, Jerry, very much. Just on the question of criteria you talked about, I think it really depends from the global governance perspective on which area we would be looking at. We're dividing it into safety, security, and non-proliferation. And I think if we look at each of those three areas, we're going to be having different criteria on what we think is a valid goal. Clearly, our criteria won't be perfection. I think that's impossible. In the area of safety and security, for instance, I can imagine we would have some criteria at least with regard to globalizing the regulatory framework, so that safety and security at least is at a certain minimum level in countries around the world, rather than being up to governments themselves to choose their own level. That will be the sort of criteria I think we would be looking at in those areas. In the area of non-proliferation, I think we would be looking at the question of how to strengthen the non-proliferation regime in a way that is acceptable on the basis of equity. At the moment, one of the huge barriers to making what I think is a reasonable non-proliferation regime move towards greater universality is this idea that it not be discriminatory. So one of the criteria we'll be using in that non-proliferation area is the standard we are seeking, are the proposals for improvement we're seeking acceptable broadly or more broadly than they are now to the international community? So do they take the sting out of the discriminatory nature of the current system? Are they more equitable than they currently are? As I say, I'm not sure we can aim for perfection in any of these three areas, but certainly we will be looking for greater universalization, greater acceptance of the various groups of states developing and developed, those with nuclear power, those without, than currently exists. We're still in the early days, as it were, of moving on to the global governance part of the project, but certainly criteria is something we'll have to consider. Obviously, we won't be doing this in a criteria-free vacuum. Just on the supply mix decisions, you're absolutely right. Countries will have to think about nuclear not in an either-or context, but in terms of the mix of energy that they're looking at. That's something that we ourselves don't have to determine. We simply have to find out to what extent countries are seeking nuclear as part of their mix, whether it's going to go up and down depending on how they view the mix, and then arriving at some assessment of the way the collectivity, if you like, of states are moving towards nuclear or moving away. So I think the question of supply mix is implied in the way that we'll be looking at how national energy policies evolve and what conclusions they arrive at. Given also that they're a moving target, I mean, in some ways we've set ourselves an impossible task. We're trying to look 2 decades ahead as to where the nuclear situation will be. And in the meantime, as the case of Australia illustrates, countries can go back and forward and wax and wane on this issue. So it is a difficult job we've set ourselves.
Any other thoughts? Yes, Yagendra.
Thank you. 2 very brief comments. One is on the economics that you mentioned. And I've done some work on it.
The microphone?
Sorry?
Speak in the microphone so we can hear you.
I've done some work on it in India, where we had to price a reactor which was made by one monopoly corporation and sold to a generating monopoly corporation. And they're very substantial learning costs. And if you take them off, then the marginal cost is very different. Second, there were very different cost estimates from what we did at home, mm-hmm. as compared to what one of the two, there are basically 2 vendors at that point of time. So the international market was very different from the kind of cost estimates we made. And today my Chinese colleague was telling me that they have produced, they are getting into, he was telling us, a 60 megawatt fast breeder reactor from the nuclear route, and we have produced one 40 megawatts based on the thorium route. And there have been very interesting exercises done, some of which I've reported in this working paper, which for SIGI, which I used yesterday, on how you derive marginal cost estimates for producing a unit of electricity. Mm-hmm. And I would recommend for your consideration that we do that very carefully, because most of the cost-benefit economics would work out very differently depending on the way we look at it. But fortunately, there is some data available now with which we can do that. The second was the very interesting presentation today by Dr. Doudswell. Mm-hmm. And we've also done something like this in the whole area of irrigation projects, a large national consultation, because we have a lot of contentious kinds of things going on there. And I was asked to chair it. I'm supposed to be a big dam wala, but Mela Patkar was also there. And interestingly, Dr. Doudswell said something that, when you know, the safety issue she was able to really get through, and there's government acceptance, and these transparent procedures are really helpful. And so what she said was very useful. But when you get into more controversial issues, the best that you can do in these kinds of processes is only to jot the alternative viewpoints, because people feel so strongly on them, and try as you can, it becomes very difficult to get conclusions based on data. And in response to some questions, she also said the same thing. She said, you know, on these kinds of issues, we have simply listed what the alternative views are. So I think that will be a very interesting problem that you will be facing as you go along, since you're using that, and I think very rightly so, as an instrument in this project. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful. I think on the calculation of marginal costs, what will be important to us is how national policymakers perceive their own calculations. Presumably they're influenced in global calculations and perhaps the calculations of others as regards their own country, but ultimately it's how they perceive their calculations and how they make their national policy decisions based on those. So I think there are varied calculations, but ultimately the one that influences national energy policy is the one that's of most interest to us. And
if I can take one sentence on that, sure. My teacher got the Nobel Prize in econometrics, so I hope we can do a little better than just what governments say.
Indeed. You made some comments about Elizabeth Dowdeswell's presentation. I entirely agree. There will be issues that are so divisive that you simply cannot choose one extreme position or the other. But I think Elizabeth made the point that often it's useful to those advocating a position which is eventually not adopted, that at least it's clear that their view has been heard. And I think she even mentioned that at the end, even after the decision had been made, which didn't quite meet the extremes, to have them there when the decision was being announced and still presumably open to further discussion down the track was very useful. These decisions tend not to be yes or no anyway. They're ongoing evolution of national energy policy. So that's my interpretation, Elizabeth, of what you said. That seems to me.
I have Bill Graham.
Well, I think we were all very delighted by the note of optimism we got at lunchtime from Mr. Cirincione, but an optimism which largely was predicated on a series of changes in the United States and in U.S. politics and driven by U.S. politicians. Having had the experience of sitting in Geneva through some of the most depressing and inscrutable and never-ending discussions around these issues, where nothing ever got done, not only because the United States was blocking at every turn, but because China was blocking what the United States was blocking, which what Russia was blocking, which was, well, we had well-meaning powers like Canada and others running around trying to put together things. So, you know, the presentation was great, but it's predicated on solving the Middle East crisis, a few other items as well. But I think, however, it's really worthy of our consideration as a roadmap that goes ahead. So is it a reasonable suggestion to the center that one might build upon the roadmap that he laid out by going to some of the other players that will be necessary, because Washington will not determine this. It's going to be how others determine the react to Washington's proposals. And even if you made all the assumptions he gave us at lunch, would it be worth our considering what the reactions of the Chinese, the Russians, and the essential other players, Israel amongst them, would be to any such scenarios before we got believing that this is anywhere near likely?
Well, I think Joe was still in the room. Would probably like to clarify.
Not only do I think that's a good idea, I would say that's an essential idea. Number one, you can't count on the United States. Number two, other players are already doing this. I'm quite struck by the Leaders Project I just learned about that's being launched partially from CG. This is a terrific idea. Norway is working. They're working. They have their own idea for a global summit in 2010. There's something called the Middle Powers Initiative that involves a number of countries. These things are in motion. You know, and as I said, new leadership is emerging. Gordon Brown has got a very different set of policies from Tony Blair. I was present at the Carnegie Endowment this summer in June when the outgoing foreign minister, Margaret Beckett, made an incredible speech on this subject, by far the most forward-leaning speech of any foreign minister or secretary of state that I'd seen. And she had this blessed by Gordon Brown. These people want to do things. There is leadership in other countries. As we just heard, we may have a new Australian leadership soon. This leadership is emerging. There's a role for this. I just emphasize the United States because, number one, I'm American, and number two, it's been the biggest part of the problem. I mean, it's been U.S. policy that has blocked many of the things that we've wanted. And with the collapse of the neoconservative paradigm, it now opens up this space where once again these ideas can contend. There's no guarantee that our solutions will prevail, but we have this opportunity as I say, for the next 2 or 3 years to make them prevail. So I strongly endorse your initiative.
Right. Ramesh?
Just picking up and running with the same team. Trevor, you summarized your three strands as safety, security, and non-proliferation. And the comments are, I suppose, to both of you, and we'll have these debates internally too later on, I'm sure. But as we know, the choice of language in framing an issue can be very critical and politically very consequential. We certainly had that with the old debate over humanitarian intervention. Every time we used that language, the war was lost even before the normative battle could be engaged. I think you have the same risk if you frame it like that. It would be much better to frame it, the third one, as weaponization rather than non-proliferation. Because I don't think it is possible to separate non-proliferation and disarmament, linking it back to the lunchtime discussion. If weapons exist, they will proliferate. If you want non-proliferation, pursue disarmament. The policy implication of that then is that you don't separate the two. And if you do focus only on one side of the equation, all the old decades of accumulated suspicion about the nuclear apartheid agenda will come back. I don't think it's necessary to the project. Weaponization is a more neutral, politically more neutral term in that sense. And I think it is a better way of framing it rather than saying we are going to talk about non-proliferation and not disarmament.
Thanks, Ramesh. I think that's actually a useful thing to suggest for the project, because in a sense we've chosen these three terms as working titles. We're not absolutely wedded to them. But I would just add, it seems very unfortunate that over the decades the term non-proliferation has come to be skewed from its original meaning. It was really meant to refer to vertical proliferation, the acquisition of weapons increasingly by states that already had them, plus the spreading of weapons to those who didn't. And over recent years, non-proliferation has come to mean only stopping further states from acquiring nuclear weapons. So in some ways, I prefer our project to re-seize the original meaning of the term non-proliferation to mean that the nuclear weapon states themselves need to do something about the problem by paying attention to their obligations under Article 6 of the NPT on nuclear disarmament. We can consider the term weaponization, but it would sit rather oddly with safety and security, which tend to be positive words in the lexicon, whereas weaponization has a rather negative one. But I take the general thrust of your point that we shouldn't be wedded to terminology if it's inappropriate, and indeed if it scares the horses, then that's simply not appropriate for the project. So I think that's certainly wise that we should think very carefully about our working titles.
Michael Small.
Thank you. Just two comments generally directed towards the research project, things you might want to bring out in the project or in future colloquium. The first is sort of more conventional, the second is a little more way out. The first is there was one bullet on one slide referring to the shortage of skilled human resources in terms of ramping up the number of nuclear power plants or even the refurbishing of nuclear power. From what I've heard anecdotally from other people in a few other presentations, this is a major bottleneck, and I mention this because we're sitting in next to Canada's foremost engineering faculty in the place where the people who will be needed to run and refurbish the existing, never mind the world, just Ontario's own nuclear power plants sit. And I really wonder how many new nuclear engineers are being graduated or will be graduated. That's a constraint all by itself. I'm sure the IAEA looks at it, but it might be worth bringing out a bit in the future. Mm-hmm. It may also have a bit more of a bearing on international cooperation as well, of a soft but important kind in terms of training nuclear engineers and skilled engineers personnel in other countries that are looking to develop a nuclear energy option or rely on nuclear energy from other countries. So that would be worth elaborating. The second is far much further out, but I was just thinking, what's the future intersection of any evolution of global governance around nuclear energy and any evolution of global governance around climate change? I mean, whatever emerges post-2012, assuming something does, is going to have to manage, ultimately, some kind of global cap and trade system and emissions permitting and all the rest of it. and will increasingly have driven behind it some notion of climate security, which has been put out and will become more and more evident as the impact of climate change becomes more evident. So there will be more of an intersection between this particular future wedge, which has got incredible complexities, and the whole everything else that we have to do on climate change. And I simply say that as you finish your project, even a little bit of speculation on the intersection between not one but two incredibly complex issues would be a great point of departure.
Thank you, Michael. As Trevor knows very well, one of my mantra is to try to keep the project within manageable terms, because indeed through this project one can tackle very broad issues, and therefore we have a choice to make. That's why I think we've made very clear this is not about providing the ultimate analysis as to whether or not there's going to be a nuclear renaissance, how big, don't have a very, very detailed economic analysis. The first part of the project is to get enough of a picture of the various scenarios possible, how big, what kind of technology, to allow us to focus in a realistic way on governance problem. But even when we look at governance problem, we will have to decide where we draw the line. Are we going to talk about governance problem in a way as to include the related governance challenges? How far are we going to go down the line of talking about disarmament and the political challenges of dealing with Iran or North Korea or whatever? We will have at some point to draw lines, because the ultimate purpose of this project is to propose publicly practical steps that governments that care about safe and secure use of a nuclear power that they can take and promote internationally, starting with our own government. And therefore, we'll have to make some choices and draw some lines. But I found the discussion very, very illuminating as to how big a challenge we'll have in deciding where we draw the line, because indeed you have certainly helped me to make a lot of connections that will inevitably have to be addressed when we come down to preparing our final recommendations. Yes?
Could I just make a point on the question of skilled personnel? I think I did have it on my PowerPoint, and I think that's certainly a factor in the expansion of the nuclear industry. But even more worrying from a global governance perspective, there's going to be a skill shortage in relation to the IAEA and International Inspectorate. If we have a vast expansion of nuclear energy and all these plants have to be safeguarded, the agency will have to vastly increase its recruitment. It's already, as I understand it, facing block obsolescence, if you want to use that term, in relation to its inspectorate, who came from an entirely different generation. So there already you have a skill shortage, not just in the industry, but in safeguarding and verifying the responsible practices of the industry. And I think our project may even come out with proposals that we increase things like inspections when it comes to safety and security, as well as non-proliferation, so that in turn would require yet another inspectorate and indeed more skills. So it is a serious problem from both sides of the scale, if you like.
Anselima? And then I think I can hear champagne corks.
Yeah. As we are looking into the future, may I come back to an allusion Monsieur Giscard d'Estaing made when he said goodbye to us before leaving. And this is, I would like to refer to this project ITER, fusion energy as the new source for the future. There is a group of countries, European Union, Japan, Russia, meanwhile India and others, the United States joined at a later stage, have started to build a multi-billion project in the south of France. This is a European project, but France was chosen. I won't go into the details, but I want to mention that Canada, though no longer playing a role actively now has a very honorable and important history in this game. I have had the privilege to be in this discussion as well. This is why I tell you, if Canada at the time would not have presented a side proposal, there was the great danger that the whole negotiation process would have collapsed. Meanwhile, I would suggest that we see this as a realistic alternative to fission reactors. It is the idea that you imitate the production of energy which is produced on the sun. Heat, the pressure, everything is imitated, and you get energy without needing uranium, without having to fear the same radiation the waste problem. The idea is that within 40 years a machine will be ready to start production of energy, and then a second 20 years period, then there will be a demonstration reactor, and then it should be commercially viable. It is the future, but I would propose that when you look into this, you should not forget the future in comparison to the near future. And think about the very important role Canada has played. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, final question.
Hello. I'm Nick Petten from the University of Waterloo. I'm an undergraduate student. And I was wondering, within your respective organizations, how you might be influencing and motivating young leaders to take responsibility for the future energy concerns.
Well, you will be happy to know that a number of young people are associated with the project. I think there are a couple of people based here in Waterloo, and there's a small team as well based in Ottawa with Trevor, who are going to be involved in the research. So I hope that this will give us a chance to see how the younger generation sees problem, because clearly people of my generation have already decades of familiarity with a certain way of seeing the world, seeing how problems come up, and your generation may have a different set of preoccupations and may see the same problems from a different angle. So yes, we do have young people involved in the project. This is of course a project that does not involve public consultations. It's well beyond our capacity to do what Elizabeth Dowdswell has done on the issue of nuclear waste disposal. Our project is more modest, and it's more modest in resources. That said, just as the conference today was open to a number of students from Waterloo, we will certainly try to bear that in mind when we organize a few other events of a comparable size. We may have one more event in the life of the project where we will be in a position to have a significant number of people in a conference setting, and we certainly will try to ensure that we have students who care and are interested. More broadly speaking, the purpose of the project that we've initiated is in part to generate a bit of discussion in Canada on these issues. It's not very much on our radar screen at the moment publicly. I think we have every reason, as a country that has ample resources in uranium and sell on the market, a country that has nuclear technology and certainly exports its technology, as a country that has had forever a very, very strong policies on non-proliferation. There's a base there to make Canada a voice that matters in these debates. And very modestly, I hope that the report we produce will be one of the ways in which Canadian population's attention is brought to the complex issues related to nuclear energy and proliferation concerns and global governance concerns, and that it will contribute in a modest way to generating debate and make people better aware of the issues that are involved in this particular set of problems. If there is no one else asking for the floor, I just want to conclude this day by first thanking our outstanding panelists and speakers. I think you will agree with me that we have been really lucky to have such high-quality presentations, which I think have generated very high-quality exchanges between the audience. So I guess I should compliment the audience, too, but I've rarely seen such coherent dialogue in a large group like that on issues that are, after all, pretty complex. It would have allowed us to be all over the map, but in fact, thanks to the high quality of the presentations that we've had, I think we've kept our focus all day, and that's really very rewarding for us. And I want to thank, therefore, all our panelists, our lunchtime speaker, and all of you. But I want to reserve my final thanks to Trevor and his assistant Scott Lofquist, Morgan, and the little team that's now working on the project. You now understand why I said at the beginning that I thought I'd found the perfect project director. Trevor and his little team were entirely responsible for putting together this day, for identifying the speakers, and for making sure that we had a vision of what this day should accomplish. And I think it certainly met all our expectations. So, Trevor, thank you very much. And I want to thank you all for